welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This is Michael Hansen with the Mind Web story from the book Wonder Makers 2, edited by Robert Hoskins. This is The Evergreen Library by Bill Pronzini and Jeffrey Wallman. The revelation that he had never previously visited the estate of old Pruitt Evergreen in all the years he had handled the aged and white-haired gentleman's legal affairs struck Simon Graham for the first time as he guided his Lincoln Continental along the Dutch Elm-bordered private lane. Not once had he had the occasion to make the long drive from Philadelphia through meandering miles of autumnal-colored Pennsylvania countryside. And Graham found himself wondering at Evergreen's lack of hospitality over the last 3 decades. After all, he had represented old Pruitt's mundane and infrequent needs ever since he had begun his practice prior to the Second World War, carrying out whatever wishes were asked of him during personal contact at his office or by telephone. It was ironic, Graham thought, that this first visit would undoubtedly be his last, for its causal purpose was Pruitt Evergreen's death of a simple coronary the previous Thursday. Although he would, after his own fashion, miss the wry wit and gentle, amiable manner, Graham could not help but feel old Pruitt had had a long and comfortable life, a happy one, and that his passing was without regrets. In fact, it had almost been as if Evergreen had foreseen his mortal end, for his last visit to Graham's office had concerned the drafting of a will and instructions as to the apportionment of his property. That meeting had been short and businesslike. Since Evergreen had no living relatives, was the last of a Pilgrim family which had settled the area in 1630. The bulk of the estate was to pass to the Enchiridion Society, a European group of which Graham knew little, save that it had something to do with books, Enchiridion being an archaic sort of synonym for book, and that old Pruitt had had a lifelong attachment to it. A representative of the society was arriving in Philadelphia the following afternoon, and as Evergreen's duly appointed legal delegate, Graham had decided on the impromptu visit to make certain everything on the estate was in order. He rounded a gentle curve now, passing through a thick copse of the Dutch elms, and there, in a wide clearing, 100 yards distant, he saw the Evergreen mansion. It was a true anachronism in the modern world of high-rise concrete and glass and suburban stucco. Constructed of rust-colored brick, hand-mortared with care and precision, it had withstood 2 centuries of natural erosion. It was huge, of pre-revolutionary design, 2-storied and elongated, with a sloping gabled roof from which jutted a series of darkly wood-framed dormer windows. A narrow widow's walk followed the width of the dwelling above the second-story front. Behind and to one side was a carriage house and 2 small outbuildings which had once quartered servants. Graham entered a circular drive and brought the Continental to a stop before the porch grown heavy with scarlet bougainvillea. He sighed ponderously as he stepped from the large car. Once a college athlete, he had dined on too much gourmet food and drunk too much fine wine with the success of his law practice to retain his youthful physique. But the extra girth that had come with middle age only seemed to add judicious solidarity to his bearing. His conservative herringbone suit and rigidly proper posture gave him the attitude of ultra-respectability, an attitude which he cultivated wisely. He had a round, trusting face with penetrating gray eyes and a firm, resolute mouth that rarely smiled. Life, with its attendant responsibilities and decisions, was much too sober a burden for levity. Yet surrounded as he now was by heavy wood and the imposing Evergreen mansion and grounds, Graham sensed a certain diminishing of his own status. There was about this place an air of quiet antiquity, which was at once serenely relaxing and faintly disquieting. It was almost as if time had somehow ceased its inexorable passage on the grounds of this estate, allowing it to remain forever as it had been during the era of Washington, Jefferson, and the Declaration of Independence. He walked onto the porch and fitted into the door lock the large brass key which until last Thursday had belonged to Mrs. Donnelly, Pruitt Evergreen's housekeeper. He swung open one half of the arched double doors which served as the main entrance. They were fastened at either jamb by wide triangular hinges much in the fashion of New England church doors, and the one creaked vaguely in the late afternoon stillness. The sound had an odd, melancholy quality in Graham's ears. He stepped inside, pulling the door closed behind him. He stood in a large vestibule, shadowed, smelling mildly but not unpleasantly of age must. On his left, the vestibule opened into a massive sitting room with a high beam ceiling and an impressive stone and mortar fireplace which comprised one entire wall. The furniture was old and heavily ponderous, built solidly by wood craftsmen whose lifespan had not nearly approximated that of their creations. On his right, Graham saw a smaller entranceway which afforded him a look into a good-sized dining room. Across its bare, polished hardwood floor, he could see through another doorway into a Quaker-like kitchen, functional and without neoteric luxuries. At the far end of the vestibule was a wide, curving staircase of thick, varnished wood with gleaming and highly ornate banisters. He entered the sitting room and stood for a moment in the center of the floor. He had a brief feeling of inconsequentiality, as he had upon leaving his car outside, but he refused to allow it to linger. He thought, as his eyes moved about the room, that if he were to call out, the heavy walls would send his voice back to him in a series of reverberating echoes. Pruitt Evergreen had died in that room. Mrs. Donnelly, a matronly woman who came twice each week, had discovered his body sitting peacefully in the ancient colonial rocker near the hearth, a pipe with blackened dottle in its bowl clasped in one hand, his shoeless feet placed comfortably on the tufted footrest. If the housekeeper could be believed, there had been a slight and beatific smile on the old man's lips, though of course Graham considered this observation to be feminine hyperbole. He spent the next 15 minutes wandering from room to room on the main floor, admiring with an appreciative eye the fine old appointments contained in each. As he passed through a small sewing room, he noticed a curtained area at one end. He parted the drapery there, revealing a tiny alcove. Set into the wall opposite was a great oak door with a brass knob and an imposing key latch. Graham wondered in a perfunctorily curious way what lay beyond it. And after a moment, he approached the door. He tried the brass knob and found it locked securely. Odd, he thought, frowning. And then he remembered the ring of two keys which Pruitt Evergreen had given him during that last farewell visit. Graham's instructions had been to present them to the Enchiridion Society representative when the time came. He had brought them along on today's journey solely because, being a meticulous man, there was the possibility that they might become necessary. Selecting the larger of the two keys, Graham unlocked the oak door and pushed it open. A murky darkness was all he was able to discern at first, but once his pupils dilated sufficiently, he determined that the room was a huge library, though rather a strange sort of library for a private dwelling. The walls were literally coated with books on gnarled, warped, unvarnished wooden shelves from floor to ceiling, and extending, for as far as he could see in the dimness, lines of similar shelves with narrow aisleways between them comprised the remainder of the room, and Graham was reminded of the stacks in a public or college library. There was, however, no apparent reading area. There were only books. What looked like hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of books. He took two tentative steps into the room. The ceiling was relatively low, certainly much lower than those in the house's other chambers, and Graham concluded that there was at least one other floor above him. As his eyes grew more accustomed to the gloom, he saw a pair of narrow spiral staircases of the type found in public libraries, which wound upward, confirming his deduction. On his left, Graham saw two thin, tall windows rising beyond the ceiling to some indeterminate height. Their multi-paned glass was so begrimed as to allow very little light to pass through. What few rays did manage to penetrate were further diffused by the swirling eddies of flaking, pale ash dust his intrusion had disrupted. It seemed as if the housekeeper, for some inexplicable reason, had never been permitted into the library for purposes of cleaning. The front section of the house was immaculate. Automatically, Graham's hand touched the inside wall in search of a light switch, but he found none. Not only had the library peculiarly been denied cleaning, he decided, but the luxury of electricity as well. He moved forward slowly as one does when entering a dark and unfamiliar cellar. His eyes caught on the floor near the end of the nearest stack a volume which had apparently fallen from its place on one of the shelves. He picked it up and opened it to the frontispiece, Twice Told Tales by Nathaniel Hawthorne. There was no copyright date, although the book's date of publication was clear, 1837. While Graham was not by any means a bibliophile, there was no doubt in his mind that this was a first edition. It had that unmistakable, somehow tangible feel of rarity, of fragility, which can only be associated with genuine antiques. He rubbed some of the dust from the binding with the tips of his fingers carefully and then attempted to replace the book on the shelf. As he did so, his eye caught the printing on the spine of another of the books there. Twice Told Tales by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Graham peered at it for a moment. It was obviously a duplicate, a much later edition. Its binding was without age cracks, freshly printed. Now that was damned queer, Graham thought. Why had Evergreen allowed a new edition of a work to be shelved while an extremely rare first edition was permitted to lie in thick dust on the floor? He placed the first edition beside the copy and then crossed to the far right-hand wall. He scanned the titles of the books on the shelves there and lying carelessly on the floor, and his amazement grew by leaps and bounds. Evergreen's library contained tomes of incalculable worth, almost all of which were yellowed, fragile, crumbling. It was a collection of Americana to stagger the imagination. There, cradled in a mound of ashen dust, the first book printed in the English colonies at Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1640, Bay Psalm Book, that alone was worth a king's ransom. And there, beyond it, the New England Primer, 1683. And beyond that, Cotton Mather, Wonders of the Invisible World, 1693. Graham continued slowly along the narrow aisleway, and a certain anger began to build inside him. First editions of volumes which had achieved some degree of fame, whether historical or purely on literary merit, had been permitted to lie disintegrating on the dusty floor, while obviously new copies were granted shelf space. Dust-filled gaps in the rows apparently indicated the original resting place of the rare first editions. Thomas Paine, Common Sense, an original pamphlet, 1776. Joel Barlow, Hasty Pudding, 1796. Washington Irving, History of New York, 1809. What the devil had possessed Evergreen? Graham wondered. Had he somehow not realized the value of his possessions? No, that was highly unlikely. A schoolboy would have recognized the priceless books which the library contained. Perhaps he'd simply lost interest in it, had ceased in his declining years to care whether such literary treasures decayed into oblivion or not. The Saturday Evening Post, first issue, 1821. James Fenimore Cooper, Last of the Mohicans, 1826. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Outremer, 1833. How had old Pruitt managed to collect such a fantastic storehouse of valuable publications? Certainly he could not have acquired them alone, without help, Graham frowned. What of the Enchiridion Society, that rather mysterious European organization to which Evergreen had willed his estate? Could it be that he had obtained assistance, financial backing from them? It was possible, of course, but the prodigious amount of labor, of money involved, would have taxed any public institution. Surely placing such an endeavor beyond the realm of feasibility for an obscurely private group, why, the necessary funds alone would have been prohibitive for 1 year, much less a lifetime. Edgar Allan Poe, Tales of the Grotesque and Arabesque, 1840. Herman Melville, Typee, 1846. Henry David Thoreau, A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, 1849. Graham considered, Perhaps the library had been Pruitt Evergreen's heritage, begun 80 years previously by the first Evergreen and subsequently handed down from generation to generation with each succeeding member of the family, adding those books which had achieved some degree of status in American literature during his own lifetime. That, at least, made a certain sense and would explain the last of the Evergreens having willed the estate to a book society. Two, there was the fact that those publications remaining on the shelves had not been arranged by the Dewey Decimal System, or by author, or by any other normal means of cataloging, but that they were, however, placed in a kind of careless chronological order. Most of the titles of lesser-known works were past all decipherability, if indeed the volumes themselves had not disintegrated partially or completely. Still, the question of why the newer editions of the most famous, the most important, the most valuable items had been purchased and then put on the shelves in their chronological place, while the first editions lay moldering on the dusty floor, was left unanswered. Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin, 1852. Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass, 1855. Atlantic Monthly, first issue, 1857. The room appeared to stretch endlessly, its rear wall but a nebulous outline in Graham's vision, seemingly no closer than when he had begun. He paused. Surely this house, elongated though it was, could not be as long as it presented itself. It must be a trick of perspective, he thought, an optical illusion. He moved forward, and then paused again next to one of the tall windows. He rubbed at a pane of glass in an effort to see what lay outside, but the grime had corroded the glass to permanent frostiness. He could see nothing. Turning frontally again, he spied, in a hiatus in the shelving, one of the narrow staircases which led upward to a second floor. He found himself wondering if his theory of a heritage of bibliophiles was indeed accurate. What contributions Pruitt Evergreen might have made to the library before allowing it to go to seed. He mounted the wooded stairs. The second floor was an exact duplicate of the main one below. Even the tall, thin windows stretched upward beyond the ceiling. How many more floors were there, he wondered. Certainly no more than one. At the most, two. The house had only two stories. He started down the nearest corridor, noting by the colorful jackets and modern bindings which decorated shelving not quite so gnarled, so warped as that of the previous floor, that he had advanced more than 60 years in literary time, and possibly this was the last floor of the library after all. Nevertheless, the dust here was almost as thick as it had been below, and the most famous, the most acclaimed volumes again lay strewn profusely about the pottery floor. Sherwood Anderson, Winesburg, Ohio, 1919. F. Scott Fitzgerald, This Side of Paradise, 1920. T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland, 1922. Ernest Hemingway, In Our Time, 1924. The volumes grew more and more familiar, and Graham saw that a good number of the better-known periodicals of the era now graced the shelves. Pruitt Evergreen's contribution to his lineage had been no small one. That was readily apparent. In fact, to have collected even a representative cross-section, a relatively large percentage of the inestimable amount of magazines and books which America consumed was almost beyond comprehension. Titles assailed his eyes in passing: Gone with the Wind, Of Mice and Men, The Male Animal, A Bell for Adano, The Iceman Cometh, Intruder in the Dust, Death of a Salesman. Graham stopped short, his forehead corrugating as he peered into the dimness ahead of him. Was that a door set into the side wall? He moved closer. Yes, a heavy oak door, like the one through which he had first passed into the library downstairs, set into a projected frame. He approached it, tested the brass knob, found it locked. Instinctively, he removed the key ring from his pocket and fitted the second of the two keys into the lock. The key turned, and the door swung inward. Graham stood on the threshold for a long moment, nonplussed at what he saw within. It was a cavernous room, its ceiling constructed of domed, green glass, a kind of arboretum of the type popular in country houses of past centuries. It had apparently been converted into an office of sorts, for in its exact center sat a huge, gleaming, gunmetal gray desk. It was cluttered with papers, books, and periodicals. More shelves of strong, unmarked, and oddly greenish-brown wood lined all four walls. A large metal cart on casters sat next to one of the shelved walls. More books and magazines were piled on it. He entered the room, pausing a scant few paces beyond the door and then moving forward circumspectly. His leather-soled shoes echoed on the glistening, almost sterile tile floor, and his eyes were on the closest row of shelves. They were filled with hardcover and paperback books, magazines, pamphlets, every conceivable manner of literary endeavor. But Graham noticed, as he drew nearer, that they stretched in an unbroken line from one end of the room to the other without gaps, that all the spines of the publications were void of marking, and that they all seemed to be of the same olive color, some brighter, verging on brown or black, some lighter, almost whitish. Graham reached out a tentative hand to the nearest shelf and rested his fingers on one of the larger hardcover books. He attempted to pick it from its place, but the tome seemed to protest, as if it were somehow fastened to the greenish-brown shelf. Finally, however, it broke free, and he lifted it down, opened it. The pages were blank. A coldness pressed between Graham's shoulder blades. He turned page after page, finding them extremely unpliable, not at all like the leaves of a book ought to be. He looked up again at the rows of olive spines, and the coldness spread viscidly along his back as a thought passed into his conscious mind, a thought which had found spawn sometime during his traversement of the stacks, but which his subconscious had refused to allow him to then consider. He stared at the shelves, greenish brown, smooth, unridged, like newly blossoming trees in an orchard. The book in his hand, olive-spined, stiff-paged, incomplete, refusing at first to budge as if it had been attached to the wood of the shelf by some invisible umbilical stem, like a piece of ripening fruit, almost ready for the picking. First editions, fully ripened fruit. Copies of them, a fresh yield from an old but strong tree. Obscure titles, a poor yield rotting into oblivion from a weak tree. Suddenly, Simon Graham knew what the Enchiridion Society was. Faceless, nameless caretakers, the guardians of world literature, with a branch in every nation bearing native fruit, with roots that were buried in the centuries past. And he knew, as irrevocably, that old Pruitt Evergreen had been the last of the lineage which had been the society's custodian of American letters. God in heaven, the implications were myriad. There were no writers, no editors, no publishers. There was only a masterful delusion so carefully cultivated to protect a secret which, if known, would literally destroy the foundations of civilization. A sharp sound behind Graham sent him whirling about, a small cry building in his throat, the hairs on the back of his neck rising. His widened eyes rested immediately on a well-known, widely circulated magazine which had fallen from one of the nearby shelves. But there was no gap in the smooth, unbroken line to show its original location. Trembling, he picked it up. Multicolored, fully printed, complete. He opened it at random, and the words leapt out to strike his eyes with pure force. He recoiled, the cry gushing from his throat now, stumbling backward, the coldness enveloping him, consuming him. The words, the revelation that he had never previously visited the estate of old Pruitt Evergreen in all the years he had handled the aged and white-haired gentleman's legal affairs, struck Simon Graham for the first time as he guided his Lincoln Continental along the Dutch elm-bordered private lane. His first impulse was to hurl the magazine from him, as if it were something unutterably alien. But a terrible fascination, an overwhelming compulsion, took hold of him. Like a man possessed, he read on. He walked onto the porch and fitted into the door lock the large brass key which had until last Thursday belonged to Mrs. Donnelly, Pruitt Evergreen's housekeeper. A murky darkness was all he was able to discern at first, but once his pupils dilated sufficiently, he determined that the room beyond the door was a huge library. Graham considered. Perhaps the library had been Pruitt Evergreen's heritage, begun 10 score years previously by the first Evergreen, and subsequently handed down from generation to generation. Graham stood on the threshold for a long moment, nonplussed at what he saw within. It was a cavernous room, its ceiling constructed of domed, green glass, a kind of arboretum. A sudden sound behind Graham sent him whirling about, a small cry building in his throat, the hairs on the back of his neck rising. Graham tore his eyes from the magazine page. No, 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 his mind screamed. No, God, no, it wasn't possible. How could he be reading about himself in the abstract? How could everything that he had done, seen, been a part of on this day, rest in neat rows of type before his eyes? It was almost as if he existed solely in terms of that story. Almost as if reality was literature and literature reality. But that was inconceivable. He was of flesh, of blood. He lived and breathed and walked and thought and spoke. He had hopes and desires. He had memories. He was alive. He was real. Wasn't he? Wasn't he? The ending. If this insane possibility were somehow true, then he would end when the story ended. He would simply cease to be. In horror, his eyes flew back to the magazine, to the last few lines of the story, to the very last sentence. Graham dropped the magazine, screaming, and... Graham dropped the magazine, screaming, and... This time is called The Evergreen Library, written by Bill Bronzini and Jeffrey Wallman. The Evergreen Library appears in Wonder Makers 2, a collection edited by Robert Hoskins. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production on Mind Webs by Leslie Hilsenhoff.